Okay, so just to remind you that historically we've had very high incidence of meningococcal disease in the United States, as high as 10 to 15 cases per 100,000, with large cyclical outbreaks in sort of the pre-World War II era. And prior to the advent of effective antibiotics against Neisseria meningitidis, case fatality ratios as high as 70%. And then this sort of shows the more recent epidemiology. We still see waxing and waning disease incidence, and I would still remind you that one in four cases is either fatal or results in permanent disability, so it remains a very serious illness, despite being at historic lows in terms of incidence, historic nadirs and incidence. this slide shows rates of meningococcal disease by age group over time in three-year intervals, just to highlight that the highest incidence is actually in infants, and then you see the second peak in incidence among adolescents, and including you see the increasing incidence in the adolescent young adult age group that was recognized in the 90s that led to elucidation of college freshmen living in dorms as a group at increased risk for meningococcal disease and for our permissive vaccine recommendations with polysaccharide vaccine. And you'll see, too, that we've seen declines in incidence over time across all age groups. And so Neisseria meningitidis are encapsulated gram-negative bacteria. They're coated with a polysaccharide capsule that is an important component or determinant of the natural immune response to infection, and is also the target for vaccines. Vaccines use these capsular serogroups as their target and to which you mount an immune response with vaccination. It also allows us to subdivide the species into serogroups. So among a dozen or so invasive serogroups, this is where we get serogroup A, B, C. And so in the U.S., these data are from ABC's active bacterial core surveillance. Roughly a third of disease in the U.S. is caused by each of serogroups B, C, and Y. And not only does the incidence vary by age and over time, but also varies by serogroup. And so this shows you in red the emergence of serogroup Y disease that occurred during the 90s, and in fact has somewhat gone away, and so a significant decline in serogroup Y disease. Also a decline in serogroup C disease in blue, and relative persistence of serogroup B disease. And then this just more specifically shows that we've actually seen statistically significant declines in the incidence of serogroup C and Y disease, but not of serogroup B. The orange bars here indicate serogroups contained in the current vaccines, the polysaccharide and conjugate meningococcal quadrivalent vaccines, ACYW135. And so among adolescents and adults, roughly 70 to 75% or more of cases are of serogroups contained in the vaccines and therefore potentially vaccine preventable. In contrast, in children under 10, the proportion of vaccine preventable or potentially vaccine preventable serogroups is lower. And in fact, serogroup B causes more than 50% of disease in infants. Just to remind us that, and you're well aware, that outbreaks of meningococcal disease occur. We have a fairly specific outbreak definition of 10 cases, 10 primary cases, or per 100,000 within a three-month period of time. And so clusters certainly occur that don't reach the outbreak case definition. This is just a spot map of outbreaks that occurred between 1994 and 2001. The majority of these are institution-based outbreaks, in part because of the way we define them, so schools or colleges, but population-based outbreaks also occur. And these certainly make the news when they happen and engender a lot of concern among affected communities or institutions, but I would just remind you that 93% of meningococcal disease cases in the U.S. are sporadic. secondary cases don't occur associated with those. And in part, that's due to very good case finding, contact tracing, and recommendations and prophylaxis for close contacts of cases in a timely fashion. And so our current vaccine recommendations are really preferentially for meningococcal conjugate vaccine for all adolescents. And that's ideally routine vaccination at the 11 to 12 year old preventive healthcare visit in conjunction with other recommended preteen vaccines, as well as clinically effective preventive services. And then catch up, basically, or vaccination at the earliest opportunity for other adolescents who have not yet been vaccinated. Then we also recommend vaccination of persons at increased risk between the ages of 2 to 55 years with Menactra. And that includes both medical reasons for increased risk, like asplenia and terminal complement component deficiencies, but also travel or residence in areas where meningococcal disease is endemic or epidemic or hyperendemic, and also for outbreak response for people at increased risk based on being in an outbreak setting. Now, we've just recently at ACIP addressed, so Menactra was licensed now for 2 to 10-year-olds, and we made the recommendation for 2 to 10-year-olds who are at increased risk to preferentially receive Menactra rather than polysaccharide vaccine. And then we've just visited the general recommendation. And so I'll talk a little bit about some of our considerations. But in the 11 to 19-year-old age group that's our current adolescent vaccination target, there are roughly 250 cases a year in the U.S. In contrast with 2 to 10-year-olds with about 160 cases per year, and in fact also about 160 cases among 0 to 2-year-olds. So the adolescent vaccination recommendation and the establishment of the adolescent vaccine platform in that 11 to 12-year-old healthcare visit catches adolescents as they begin to enter a period of increasing risk for meningococcal disease, and that protection that they achieve should carry them through their period of increased risk, especially as college freshmen. In contrast, a 2-year-old recommendation would catch kids on a pretty significant downslope of risk for meningococcal disease. And then finally, again, 70% or more of cases in adolescents are of vaccine-preventable serogroups. In contrast, fewer than half in infants and roughly 50% in the 2 to 10-year-old age group are. So we actually ACIP did not recommend routine immunization for the 2 to 10-year-old age group. And so a part of that decision also was clearly in the context of an ongoing and evolving prevention program for meningococcal disease. And so what are our further opportunities for prevention? Well, really improving adolescent coverage, and I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. And then probably in the next 2 years, we'll are very likely to have one of the following three things, either a single-dose toddler ACYW vaccine or probably a 2-dose infant toddler, sort of 9 months and another dose ACYW vaccine. And also in development, and some of the vaccine manufacturers are a 2-4-6 month infant ACWY vaccine with a booster in the second year of life. And then we're probably 3 to 5 years from a vaccine a licensed vaccine that'll be effective against serogroup B. So I said our stated goal in the ACIP statement is routine vaccination of adolescents at a pre-adolescent 11 to 12-year-old healthcare visit. And so from the first NIS teen survey from the sort of took place during late 2006, early 2007, we know that coverage in this age group is roughly 12% with meningococcal conjugate vaccine. But Sanofi Pasteur, the vaccine manufacturer, has some pretty encouraging data that ordering and shipment of vaccine or purchasing of vaccine has really taken off substantially since then. And so a lot of doses are going out the door, and 90% or more of those really go into this age group. So we're probably getting very close to to good coverage, 40 and 50% or so within the next few years. And then just a little bit, so it probably is better to go after Kristen, because Kristen talked to you about some work that she did with Ben Silk in looking at H flu serotype reporting through NEDS. And so we've done the same thing with meningococcal serogroup reporting. And so, I mean, I've told you how there really is a microepidemiology to meningococcal disease, and the incidence varies from state to state and even county to county, and the serogroup distributions vary. And where we happen to be at sort of a historic nadir of disease. And so we really are turning to NEDS to make those data better, more usable for us to understand really the national epidemiology of meningococcal disease. And so these data are important both for local decisions about vaccination around clusters of disease or outbreaks, but also to make national program decisions about implementation of vaccines, as well as to inform vaccine development. And so these are some published data that really show quite variable completeness of serogroup reporting for meningococci in NEDS, ranging from sort of 10 or a little over 10% to about 70%. And then our more recent experience with NEDS surveillance data with that they've been working with is consistent with this, so quite variable and not at all complete. And as Kristen told you about, that we run into sort of two problems. One is serogrouping is not always performed, but in general, usually it is, because people know that it impacts especially vaccination decisions around clusters. And then sometimes serogroup data that exist are reported and don't make it from point A to point B, or they're just not reported. So a lot of the problems really resulted from some specific problems within NEDS that a little bit of a switch actually got us access to the data that you were reporting. And this is something that you're well more familiar with than I am, which is the variability in terms of NEDS data management systems nationwide and how data are reported and moved from you to CDC. And so it's not unsurprising that data don't always reach us. And so just to reiterate what Kristen said, these are, again, H flu serotype data, but some simple actions really improved the completeness of the serotype data that we had at CDC, and in fact categorized more things as non-typable or other types rather than HIB. And so that's really important in terms of our estimate of progress towards elimination of HIB disease. And so similarly, we're not quite as far along with meninge, but similarly, those decisions, those data will be important in our understanding of the national epidemiology of meningococcal disease. And so just a reminder, as you know, that that meningococcal disease is a medical and public health emergency, and it creates a lot of appropriate concern in affected communities and among affected families. And our goal is really a world free of meningococcal disease, and we're working towards that with an evolving prevention and control program. And so I would also say one of our objectives is complete national surveillance data, so we'll be looking to you to help with reporting of serogroup data to NEDS as we move forward. And you already have Kristen's phone number, so you can call her with those results. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, great. That was three great talks. I'd like to open the floor for questions at this time. I just asked if you have a question, please go to the microphone. No questions at all? Well, then I'll ask a question. Kristen, you mentioned that one of the problems identified was that the states are unable to tell whether or not their data has been transmitted, and I know you touched on that a little bit, but what is being done to fix that problem so that they know what's been sent to CDC and whether or not it's been received?
Come up here. So one of the things we're working on is starting this year, we're going to start sending out probably quarterly reports of HIB serotype data to states to show what we see in their data so that they can compare that to their numbers to see what they've sent. because we've found that that type of feedback is probably the best way to catch the most problems as soon as they start. So that's one of the things that we're starting. And also, Sandy Rausch has started sending out surveillance indicators yearly, so that look at multiple aspects of H flu surveillance. So we've already started identifying issues that way.
This is a question for Kristen. Our state lab does serotyping for H flu, but it seems for more than a few years now, CDC labs have been requesting that we forward the isolate even after we've done serotyping for a validation. And I'm just wondering, is that still the expectation? Should we continue to do that? Do you have any information on that?
Which state health department?
Michigan.
Okay. So we confirm, so ABCs are laboratory-based, population-based surveillance. We receive and confirm isolates. And so, no, we don't necessarily require that isolates be sent for confirmation, but that probably is a historical holdover from some work that we did in the past maybe 3 to 5 years regarding a lot of discrepancies we're finding with serotype results for H flu. From state labs and our labs, and not necessarily one was more likely to be wrong than the other, but to improve the consistency of serotype reporting. So we're always happy to help confirm or help if you have a question about the serotype results, but we don't necessarily expect to confirm everything.
Well, maybe we'll follow up then, because you know it's a lot of resources if we're pretty consistent on the results.
Sure.
And one other quick question, without going into too much detail, can you kind of quickly describe what the challenges have been in developing a serogroup B meningococcal vaccine?
The serogroup B capsular polysaccharide is very closely related to a neuraminidase that is a native antigen, basically. So it's on the surface of nerve cells within your body. And so the body, during development, learns to tolerate that antigen and not mount an immune response to it. And so it's been difficult to use serogroup B capsular polysaccharide alone to result in an effective immune response. Or at least there's been a theoretical concern about that. It actually might be possible, but in general, because of that concern, we're looking at other targets, and so I didn't mention, but there are other antigens on the surface that allow you to, that are potential targets for vaccines. They may not all be present universally like serogroup B capsule is on serogroup B isolates. And so another reason why our both serogroup and molecular subtyping of isolates becomes so important in vaccine development. And so there are several vaccine companies with programs that include serogroup B candidate vaccines that may actually be more like universal vaccines because these other antigens are targets. So lots of interesting things come in terms of meningococcal vaccines.
Okay. Hi, I'm Candida Martinez from Inter-American College of Physicians and Surgery. I work as a medical educator. And my question is about when we give the vaccine, the meningococcal vaccine, to the adolescent. How long they will be protected, and when will they need the next doses if they need it?
Everyone has that question. There are accumulating data from the first vaccine trials for Menactrin. So we're at 5 years and counting or so with appropriate levels of protection. We've assumed in estimates sort of 8 to 10 years of protection, and so we'll continue to have data moving forward and continue to look at that in terms of whether or not a booster vaccine is recommended, and if so, when. Especially because the risk after that sort of college freshman age declines pretty significantly, we're probably more likely to see a need for a booster in younger children who are vaccinated, who need to be protected till they're 19 rather than 11-year-olds.
One more question. Cynthia, you mentioned you're struggling with an exit strategy, and I'm interested in what you have considered.
Taking a new job.
Exit strategy for me or the project?
tough one, huh?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, we're trying to figure out if there's other funding to keep that particular part of the project going, or if there's some way, you know, piggybacking on other projects where we are actively trying to get pertussis cultures to kind of supplement some of that for those particular clinics. But there really isn't and I think this happens with a lot of projects that offer free testing for a set amount of time, because it tends to be the low cost, free cost clinics, right, Sharon, that are taking this. So they're the ones that need it the most, and because of their population, they're also the ones that on the litany of things they're going to be looking at in their patients, pertussis is kind of not one of the top priorities. So yeah, that's my answer.